Good evening, and welcome to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. I am Pastor Zach, and tonight we are getting a bit of a late start, as you can see. we had a little bit of work and things going on today, and I looked down at the clock and realized that it was about 5 minutes till it was time for us to start, and there was no way in the world we were going to start at that time, but we have managed to recover it. You get started here a little bit later, but we'll get it going anyway. So tonight, we are moving into the next question that's on my list, question number 3, which I technically we could take question number 3 and probably break it into 40 or 50 individual questions all within itself, but I'm going to kind of try to give you a synopsis, kind of a wrap-up of the entirety of this question. You know, our first one was that a lot of people ask, well, why does it even matter if I study the Bible? You know, I've got a pastor, I've got a preacher, I've got a Sunday school teacher, why does that matter? And then the next, second most often one that I get is the idea of why would God, blah, 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 right? Why would an all-powerful, honest God allow suffering and evil into the world? And you can switch those adjectives around all that you want. They're pretty interchangeable on the positive and the negative end of that particular statement. Excuse me. And we tackled into that one, and now the third most common question that I get from lost and, again, saved people alike is essentially, I'm taking about 30 different questions and wrapping them into one. What happens at the end of the world? A lot of people have some very, very large misunderstandings, a lot that are fear-based, quite frankly, about the book of Revelation. I remember when I took the church that I pastor now, my first year here, I probably hadn't been here a month, 2 months, and there were a couple of members that asked, you know, well, can you go through the book of Revelation? And I kind of chuckled because the book of Revelation is not the first place that you ever go in a Bible study. Not even a little bit. Yet it is the most common book of almost everybody that I talk to where they'll go, you know, I just can't find, you know, I just can't find the desire to study. It's hard for me to understand the Bible, these kinds of things. And my first question to that is always, well, what book are you looking at? And about 95% of the time, this is the book. Oh, I was trying to read Revelation. I was like, well, no wonder you don't have a desire and you don't understand. Because in order to really get into the book of Revelation, you've got to know the Old Testament very, very, very well. But you also have to know the New Testament, very much so the Gospels, to be able to take and combine these two things, because Revelation is the combining, the full plan of redemption being carried out that started in the old and transformed into the new, right? And so when we're looking at this book, I get so many varying forms of the question of, well, what exactly happens at the end? And, you know, what should I be worried about? And, of course, there's always the, you know, when the tribulation starts, is the rapture at the beginning? Is the rapture in the middle? Is the rapture at the end? And then we kind of move into, you know, the question of, well, what's the purpose of the millennial reign of Christ? And what does it mean to be resurrected from the dead? And, you know, all these concepts kind of come into this one question that I get a lot of, what happens at the end? And so tonight we're not going to dive very deeply, obviously, into this, because we could probably spend 4 or 5 hours on just this discussion alone. And we probably still would not get to conclusions that many people would be happy with, okay, and would be content with. But there's a couple of things about Revelation, about the end time, whatever you want to call it, that you need to keep into perspective. First of all, that the book of Revelation is not intended to cause fear, but rather to inform. John starts out in chapter 1 of Revelation telling you that the whole point of this book is to reveal to you who Christ is going to be when he returns again. The point of the book is not to try to scare people out of hell. The point of the book is not to try to scare saved people to do the jobs they're supposed to be doing for God. The point of the book is to show you that the Jesus Christ that you know in the Gospels is not going to be the same Jesus Christ that you see at the end of the world. Jesus Christ in the Gospels is the Savior of the world. He is the Son of Man who has come to seek and to save that which is lost. But the Jesus Christ that is going to come in Revelation is coming as the King who is carrying out the justice of God on the world. That's a very different paradigm from walking around and being, you know, talking to the woman at the well, or being at the wedding in Galilee, and turning the water into wine. You know, this is not the same Jesus Christ that we see in the Gospels, in the book of Revelation. This is him as God and King come to fulfill the redemptive plan of man. And so when you keep it in that context, that definitely helps you to understand a lot more of this book. That this is not, you know, I've seen pastors do this foolishness of trying to preach Revelation and trying to preach it geared at lost people, when the book is fundamentally geared at saved people. It's written to the saved. This is what's going to happen. This is what you're working for. This is how this is going to happen. It's not about scaring anybody. It's not about freaking anybody out. It is about informing you that there is a time that is coming, and it is not going to be the way it was the last time Christ came. It's going to get very ugly very quickly. And so when we're looking at this passage, and we're talking about the question of what happens at the end, we have to first address context, meaning that this is about, but very much so, not even about quote-unquote the end of the world, but rather the redemptive plan of man being fulfilled. Those are two very different things. When you and I think of the end of the world, we kind of have this idea that, you know, the earth is going to explode, and after that, we're all gone, and that's just the end. Even Christians alike that I talk to kind of have this weird idea that that's just the end. And there's actually not an end. You have an eternal soul. Your life is going to go on well beyond after this physical body is dead. So it's not the end of anything, but rather it's the beginning of something new. And so you have to keep that in mind. This is the revelation of Jesus Christ. This is revealing him as King. The next thing that you have to focus on is that this is written to saved people. John starts going into chapter 2 and chapter 3, and he is writing, of course, led by Jesus Christ, but is writing to these seven different churches. And essentially, the message is always the same, of get your house in order, lest I destroy you, because you have a job to be doing. And if you're not doing that job, you're not only not fulfilling what you've been called to do, but you are also not going to be able to withstand the very day you're worried about coming. You know, there's a lot of people that kind of, you know, they act terrified of the end of the world, but they don't live like they're terrified of it. And that's what's going on in chapter 2 and 3, is God's going, you know, you do this right, however, I have this against you. There's only two churches that get a pat on the back and a that a boy and keep it going. The rest of them, it is get your house in order. Because when this time does come, if you're not living better than you are right now, you will surely fall. You're not going to make this through it with very much faith. You're not going to make it through it with very much help and desire to still do the right thing, even in a world that is continuously geared towards not doing the right thing. Now, that's the opening. That's the context. We're talking to save people. We are revealing Christ as King. Now, we are going to get into the nitty-gritty of the question, because this is really what people want more of. You know, you tell them all this, and there's a gold mine in chapter 1 through 3 of Revelation. I would say there's a bigger gold mine in chapters 1 through 3 than there is in the rest of the whole book. because the rest of the whole book could be summed up as we win. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. But there's some very good, solid life application in the very beginnings of these chapters. And we can dig a little bit of that out in other places of Revelation, but a lot of what you see in Revelation is, again, it's informative. It's not something that, you know, you can apply to your life today to not follow the Antichrist. You're not in that situation, right? And so the nitty-gritty of it kind of goes like this. The nitty-gritty is a lot of people do not realize there are many, many things that must happen before this time period can even begin. One of the very significant things that must happen before the tribulation can begin is that the temple must be reestablished in Jerusalem. And the reason for that is because the Antichrist at the 3.5 year mark of the tribulation is going to perform something that is referred to as the abomination of desolation. It's a very fancy way of saying that he is going to essentially desecrate the temple. And the way that this is going to be carried out is that he's going to offer a pig on the altar. You know, pigs are considered an unclean animal in Levitical law. That was not something that you could, as a Jewish person, even be associated with, let alone take to the temple and offer as a sacrifice to God. This kind of thing. And we actually have a Old Testament, between the Testaments, archetype of the Antichrist in Antiochus Epiphanes, or as the Jewish people, the Jewish culture, made fun of and called him Epiphanes, okay, which Epiphanes means Antiochus, basically the great. Epiphanes means Antiochus the fool, okay? And so what happened in that particular time period between the Old Testament and the New Testament is that Antiochus the fourth had kind of caused some problems and issues with the Israelites. They didn't really like him. He didn't really like them. But he goes to war against Egypt, and it is falsely reported that he dies in conflict while battling Egypt. And the nation of Israel is, instead of double-checking, fact-checking the story, as we would call it in today's day and time, they throw a big, huge luau because ding-dong, the witch is dead. And Antiochus the Fourth finds out that there's this major, large party going on in Israel celebrating the fact that he's dead. And he, of course, does not appreciate that's what's going on. And so he returns from Egypt, and he slaughters some 150,000 Jews, and he desecrates the temple. And that is a lot of what is reflected in Revelation about what's going to happen with Antichrist at that 3.5 year mark. So we have to have a temple. And right now there isn't one in Israel. In fact, where the temple sits, and there's some argumentation about this, and there always will be among scholars and historians and culture as a whole. But right now, where the temple would sit is where the Dome of the Rock is currently at, meaning that the only way the temple is going to be rebuilt according to Levitical law and according to the prophecies that are indicated in Revelation, the Dome of the Rock must go bye-bye. And, of course, you and I both know that's going to be quite the ordeal, seeing as how I don't think there's going to be many folks in the Middle East that are happy about the fact that that will go kaboomy, and they will be allowed to rebuild the temple. The second thing that a lot of people do not realize about this question of, you know, when does the tribulation start, is that there's actually a lot more that's going to happen before the Great Tribulation begins to set up the groundwork for the Great Tribulation. Because what occurs in the tribulation is that at the beginning of that 7 years, we have what's called the seven seals and the seven trumpets of God. And essentially, a third of the world is going to be destroyed very quickly. And then there are some wild things, some punishments and war and famine and disease. And there's going to be a lot of death and suffering, and a third of the sun's going to be blotted out. And there's going to be basically a third of land destroyed, and a third of the water and ocean, fresh water and ocean destroyed. And there's going to be all of this destruction that occurs. which is going to open the door for the false prophet and for the Antichrist to come into a position of power, because that first 3.5 years, they're the good guy. That's essentially how they are viewed by everybody. But there's a lot that is indicated in Revelation that by the time that they even can move into this power and the tribulation begins, there's going to be an establishment of a one-world government. There's going to be an establishment of a one-world religion that's going to be a mainstream religion. A lot of people, the moment you say that, they're like, oh, it's Catholicism. I have no idea. No idea. There's a lot of interesting religions that are supposedly under the umbrella of Christianity, but I would heavily argue are very much not Christian, even a little bit, if you read your Bible. And so, you know, I have no idea. More than likely, it really may be a very similar situation to what happened under Constantinople way back in, oh, I think it was, goodness, 150 AD, somewhere around that ballpark, that the Roman Empire falls, Constantinople sets up the Constantine Empire, and which is essentially in modern-day Turkey. And he understands that a lot of why Rome fell is that there wasn't a quote-unquote one government recognized religion, and establishes a lot of the modern-day religions that kind of exist now, sets that into motion by combining some elements of very loose Christianity and paganism and things of this nature. I'm sure that it's going to be something more around those lines than any religion that we know of currently today that has a large number of people. You know, I don't think that Catholicism or Islam or Buddhism or Hinduism is going to be the catalyst or the car or the pilot for this particular institution, but probably more than likely a culmination of many of these different world-renowned religions that have a lot of different followers. And so there's going to be all these things that are happening, and those things are going to be happening because we're told even by Jesus Christ in Matthew that things are going to get very, very ugly well before the tribulation actually starts. There's going to be lots of war. There's going to be rumors of war. There's going to be famines and pestilences, and there's going to be droughts, and I mean, just terrible, terrible things that are going to be going on well before this happens. And the reason for that is because the Great Tribulation is only going to be going for 7 years. You know, you can't come to power in such a short amount of time and be the hero for 3.5 years unless there's a lot of stuff already in motion before that ever begins. So there's going to be all these things already established. And the false prophet and the Antichrist are going to come to power simply because they're going to be able to do things that no one's been able to do. They're going to bring peace into the Middle East. They're going to help people survive all of these punishments and seals and trumpets that are going to occur. Because what a lot of people don't realize about Satan and Antichrist and the false prophet, which no, the Antichrist is not Satan. He's going to be a man who is very closely tied in with Satan. But Satan is referred to as the beast. The Antichrist is referred to, obviously, as the Antichrist. And the false prophet is referred to as the false prophet, meaning that there's some variations that's going to be going on here. Satan is essentially trying to establish his own mockery of the God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit setup that exists amongst the New Testament preaching and teaching of the gospel. And it's basically a slap in the face of God of, you know, his Messiah, the humanity is going to love, and God's Messiah we killed. That's essentially what this is all about. Is it's kind of like no different than what Satan does with God with Job, where he says, you know, yeah, you've taken real good care of Job, and you've done all these things for him, but you take all that from him, he'll curse you to your face. That's essentially what Satan is going to be playing out on a very massive scale, okay? And so they're going to come in, They're going to come into a very high position of authority. They're going to work signs and wonders and miracles. In fact, it's even alluded to, and we don't know 100% that the language there could go either way. But essentially, Antichrist is going to have his own death, burial, resurrection kind of moment. That there's going to be an attempt against his life, and we don't know if that's completely successful or if it's going to just be made to look as if it was completely successful. The language just doesn't paint a very clear picture there. But at the 3.5 year mark, he's going to be quote unquote assassinated and brought back from the dead. And there's going to be statues made of Satan that can actually talk and breathe fire. And essentially these two are going to put on quite the magic show, and they're going to give the mob what they want. That's essentially what they're going to do. And then, in the physical world, Antichrist is going to be assassinated at the 3.5 year mark. And as that's occurring in the physical realm, we are told that in the spiritual realm, Satan is making an attempt against heaven, and he fails miserably. That Michael and his angels cast him back down to the earth, and for the first time in known history, by this future moment, Satan will not have the ability to enter into heaven. And yes, Satan does indeed enter into heaven. He is your great accuser. He goes into heaven all the time to say, well, look at what your kids are doing. Look at what your kids are doing. Look at what your kids are doing. We even see this in Job, where he walks in the middle of the throne room and has his little sarcastic moment with God. Okay? And so, he's going to lose. He's going to be cast from heaven. And the agenda at that point is no longer conquering God, but rather causing as much destruction as possible. And he's going to go after the Israelites, specifically the 144,000 saved Jews that God is placing a special protection on during this time. And God is going to be taking care of them out in the wilderness. Some people say that that's going to happen at the city of Petra. Some people say that's going to happen in much more supernatural ways. I haven't the slightest idea. It is really not relevant. What's relevant is that God's going to take care of them. How is really an afterthought. And so after he fails in being able to catch them, he then turns to the Gentiles, or the saved that are essentially not Jews, okay? And he's going to begin to martyr and kill and destroy them. Now, that brings us to a question. And that question is, when does the rapture occur? Because, see, when people ask about the end of the world, there's more than one question that exists within that. And the short answer to that is, I haven't the slightest idea. You can believe that the rapture occurs before the tribulation begins. You can believe that it happens at the midpoint of the tribulation. Or you can even believe that it happens at the end of the Great Tribulation. And all of that depends heavily on this question of, when does God's wrath begin? And you and I could sit here and go in circles and circles and circles about that. I tell my church members all the time, we just actually ended talking about this debate. And I think we spent some 8 or 9 weeks on it because I wanted them to really dive into it and realize that I could sit down and prove either of the three to you. That's how ridiculously little we know about this concept of when the dead in Christ shall rise and when the martyred saints of the tribulation or the church, depending on what you believe about the rapture, is going to occur. And so, this 3.5 year mark, setting the rapture aside as to who exactly these saved Gentiles are, Satan is going to begin destroying every saved soul he can find that is not Jewish. And he is also going to, at this point, flip the script. The mask comes off at the 3.5 year mark. He desecrates the temple. He kills the two witnesses that are at the Wailing Wall. And things start getting ugly. We then have the seven bowls of God's wrath that are poured out on the world. we're getting near the end of things. Things are about to wrap up. And then after all of that occurs, we move into Jesus returns. We have the Battle of Armageddon. We have some judgments that occur. And then we enter into a period that is referred to as the millennial reign, which is where I get a lot of sub-questions about the big one of what happens at the end. And the millennial reign, one of the biggest questions that I always get regarding it is, what in the world is the point in this? Because the millennial reign is that Jesus rules the earth for 1,000 years. The saved are essentially under his command and in positions of authority around the world. But at the same time that this semi-perfect world exists, there are still lost people and sinners that exist in this 1,000-year period. Now, no, I have no idea if marriage is going to be the same, if people are having children, if people are still dying. These are the kinds of other questions that I get that they literally cannot answer that for you. And an actual, this is, yes, I know from this verse, this is what's going to happen with that. And I do not like to get into the realm of opinion. When you get into the realm of opinion, it's no different than taking a philosophy class. You're essentially a blind man looking for a black cat in a dark room. It just doesn't work out. And so what's important about the millennial reign, though, and what makes the millennial reign a necessary thing, because after that 1,000 years, Satan is released from where he is chained in hell. And it says that he's allowed a little time to go about and do his thing. Have no idea what that means. A little time could be a year, a little time could be 100 years. We just don't know. But he's going to amass an army in that little time, and once again, for the final time, try to overthrow Jesus Christ's physical reign in Jerusalem after this 1,000-year period called the millennial reign. And then after that, we have a new heaven, new earth, and we wrap everything up with a big bow. Okay? But the point of the millennial reign, because everybody hears that and goes, well, why in the world do we got to have a battle number two? What's the point of that? That's kind of silly. It's actually not silly. And the reason that it's not silly is because one of the oldest things that you will hear when you witness to people, and if you read any part of the Bible whatsoever, is this idea that if men could talk to God, see the miracles that occurred in the Bible in the days of the Old Testament and in the days of Jesus Christ and the early parts of the book of Acts, because the apostles quit doing these things as time progresses due to the fact that Gentiles begin to believe that they are pagan gods, essentially. The gifts start to have the reverse effect on validating the message. The reason this is important is because people say, if I could have seen any of those things that I've just mentioned, well, I would believe. Well, we know of a story in the New Testament about the rich man and Lazarus. And the rich man dies and goes to hell, and Lazarus goes to Abraham's bosom, which to us would be heaven, okay? That's a Jewish term, and we don't have the time to really get into the cultural implications of that tonight. And so, this occurs. And the rich man asks if Lazarus could put a drop of water on his tongue because, you know, the fires of hell are so hot, this sort of thing. And the angel says, no, not going to happen. And he then says, well, let me at least go back so that I can tell my brothers so that they do not end up here like I do. And the angel says, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them, a.k.a. they have the Bible. Let them hear the gospel message. And the brother argues back and says, you know, essentially, I had that same opportunity, and, you know, I didn't believe. And so the angel informs him that if even one from the dead was to go back and to tell those who would not believe the Bible, they still would not believe. And that's the point of the millennial reign. The millennial reign, Jesus Christ, is going to be ruling in a very close to perfect world, very similar to what the world was in the book of Genesis. Yet, even with literal God on the throne in Jerusalem in charge of the world, I just told you Satan is going to amass a what? An army, which means there's still going to be what? Lost people. There are still going to be people that even though God himself is sitting on the throne in Jerusalem, they won't believe. Which seems astoundingly crazy to us. But there's a ton of facts that prove the existence of God on a regular basis way outside of me even picking up a Bible. Okay, I can prove the existence of God without picking up a Bible. And furthermore, the Bible doesn't make an argument for the existence of God because it's just accepted as fact. God doesn't, I don't have to make an argument for my existence. I exist. The same is for God as well. And so, even in today's time, there are a ton of people who, with their own eyes, see and know and can tell you the facts of things that they can never understand, and they still won't believe in God. I think one of the biggest biological proofs for the existence of God completely happens within the human body all the time. You know, if you go and study just a regular, I mean regular, regular, basic, AP biology, maybe even a senior level biology class, okay? You're going to learn about how the human body and how cells and essentially all of your motor runs, okay? And what happens inside your body is as you take in food or fluids and these kinds of things, those molecules are broken down into smaller and smaller parts, and they are free-floating in your body, and your body has a very, very complex and extremely important set of chemical reactions that must constantly occur for you to continue to live. And if any of those reactions do not happen the way that they are supposed to happen and the right amount of time and at the right and precise moment, at the right and precise temperature and area and part of the body, you will die. Like, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You will die. It's no different than, you know, if you go out and you turn the key to the engine on your car and it goes da-da-da-da, cluck. Well, what's not occurring? Well, your spark plug's not lighting the carburetor, the carburetor's not spraying gas. Something, one of the reactions that needs to happen inside of the engine for the engine to activate and run, is not occurring. Therefore, the engine is dead. You're no different. It's the same thing. And when you're studying this, you find out that all of these reactions happen at random. Now, immediately after they tell you this truth, a very good biology professor will look at you and say, you know, but even though it's at random, there is just such a great amount of materials and molecules that it's random, but it's going to happen 99.9% of the time. And that's essentially their way of saying it happens no matter what. That it would never just not happen. While they're also telling you that everything that happens that makes you still work is at random. Now, I don't know about the rest of you, but if you told me that it's at random whether or not I'm going to still be breathing tomorrow, that's a little bit concerning, but it's also proof that who is in control of all of creation and all of existence on a regular basis? Well, God is, because who continues to make sure that your random chemical reactions that continue to allow you to live continue to happen the way they're supposed to, right? So, when we're talking about this end of time question, and we are talking about the millennial reign aspect of it, the reason for that 1,000 years is because if a man is not going to believe in God, it will not matter if you even put God in front of him. And so God is essentially proving to us one final time that even if he gave you everything you said you needed to believe and be saved, you still wouldn't get saved because that's not the actual reason you don't want to get saved. The real reason is that you just don't want to be. You don't want to serve God. You don't like God. You want to continue to do the things that you want to do. And God will allow you to do that. And even if that leads you into a terrible and miserable existence, God will let you have your way. You have a free will. So, essentially, after this millennial reign occurs, Satan's loose for a while, he amasses an army, he comes to attack God. God, of course, wins. There's a new heaven and a new earth, and the full redemptive plan of man is all wrapped up into a bow, the end. Okay? And that is the answer to the what is going to happen at the end of the world question. Now, I know for all of you on here, no different than my church congregation after the last 8 weeks we've spent talking specifically about this question, you probably have a ton more questions. And if you have any, you can drop it in the comment bar. You can just say, hey, you have questions, and I'll reach out to you, and I'll give you an email address. You can send those questions. I'll answer those questions for you to the best of my ability. And then we'll talk about those questions, obviously, on here as well, as I've told you guys in the past. But I want to steer you away from that particular question of what's going to happen at the end of the world to rather, are you prepared for that event? A lot of God's people, we have this really bad idea that we get saved, and after we get saved, we just kind of sit and we wait on God to come. And one of my favorite sayings in the world is that between the cross and heaven, there's a whole lot of living going on. Meaning that you have to live and act and witness and pray and study and attend your church and grow as a child of God after you're saved. Like, getting saved is not the epitome of your walk with God. That's not the high point. That's the beginning of something that is going to be so much greater the longer and longer and longer and the more and more and more you grow in the Word of God. And being consumed with the end is definitely not the way to grow as a child of God. If you want to grow as a child of God, go read about who you're supposed to be. Go read about what it is that you are supposed to be doing and how you're supposed to be acting and how you're supposed to be guiding your family and your spouse and your children and how you can make your life right here, right now, a million times better because you know the truth, not only about God, but about life. And if you're doing all of those things, you're already going to be more than prepared for whatever is going to come at the end, assuming that you and I are even alive for this particular event. So, that is the answer to what's going to happen at the end of the world. If you have any questions further on to that, there is no dumb question. Let me know. We'll answer it. But that is the very short, not too terribly crawling in-depth kind of breakdown of what's going to occur. And after going into next week, we have an interesting question next week that I'm really looking forward to. We had somebody ask about how do we rectify the existence of prophetesses in the Old Testament. How does that work with New Testament and you know, the ideals of pastors and this kind of thing? Everybody kind of gets a little bit fired up when this conversation comes. And it's a very interesting one, and you're going to learn a lot of the differences between the Old Testament and the New Testament and God's ideal plan and these types of things. So I hope that you log in for that one next week. And I hope that tonight that helped you to understand better what all is going to happen in the last days. And so I hope all of you have an excellent week. I hope that things go well for